but observe the verse that is given here at the very beginning of this hymn, Psalm 86:1. Bow down thine ear, O Lord, hear me, for I am poor and needy. Again, I mean, it reminds me of what we spoke of this morning. I mean, this is how we walk with the Lord. We are poor and needy. Bow down your ear, O Lord, and hear. We do need the Lord every hour. Well, let's turn to Revelation 17 and 18. And I want to read these two chapters together because they go together. There's a lot in here, and we're not going to get through this by any means tonight, but hopefully we'll get a good start. I'm going to mainly focus tonight on the first six or seven verses of chapter 17. But I want you to understand these go together. And as I read this, I want to point out the structure of it. And maybe I'll just say it in the beginning, and then I'll point it out as we go. In verses 1 to 6, there is this picture given of a harlot. Okay, and she's described in great detail in the first six verses. Then in verses 7 through 18 of chapter 17, there's kind of an explanation of this harlot and the beast she's riding on. The explanation, actually, as you read it, has more to do with the beast than it does actually the harlot. The harlot is kind of described a little bit at the end of this section. And then in chapter 18, verses 1 through 8, her fall is described, the fall of this harlot. And then it closes here in verses 9 through 20, there's this lament for her. The kings of the earth, the merchants of the earth, weep over the fall of this harlot. And then in verses 21 through 24, the very end of chapter 18, there is this declaration really of the completeness of this fall, that it's over for her. You know, this is it. You know, she's done. And that's kind of the outline. So I'll point those changes out as you read through it, but it maybe helps you comprehend exactly the flow as you read it rather than just reading two chapters without any thought of break. But understand, they go together. This is one, if I can put it this way, one vision. Okay, chapter, as I pointed out, chapter 16, if you would follow the flow of the chronology, in other words, the end of chapter 16, it would pick up again at chapter 19, verse 11, the chronology, when Christ returns, when Christ is seen in heaven, coming to earth. That's where the chronology picks up. Chapter 17 and 18 are more like a parenthesis, a vision, okay, between. So, starting in verse 1 of chapter 17, we have this description of a harlot, okay? Then one of the seven angels who had the seven bowls came and spoke with me, saying, "Come here, I will show you the judgment of the great harlot who sits on many waters, with whom the kings of the earth committed acts of immorality," fornication in other words, "and those who dwell on the earth were made drunk with the wine of her immorality. And he carried me away in the spirit into a wilderness, and I saw a woman sitting on a scarlet beast full of blasphemous names, having seven heads and ten horns. The woman was clothed in purple and scarlet and adorned with gold and precious stones and pearls, having in her hand a gold cup full of abominations and of the unclean things of her immorality. And on her forehead a name was written, a mystery." By the way, mystery is not her name. It's a description regarding her name. But a mystery, "Babylon the Great, the mother of harlots and of the abominations of the earth. And I saw the woman drunk with the blood of the saints and with the blood of the witnesses of Jesus. When I saw her, I wondered greatly." Now in verse 7, he starts, there's a description of the beast and the harlot, more of an explanation, if you will. In other words, he's developed this picture or this allegory, if you will, and now he's going to explain it, at least in part. Verse 7, "And the angel said to me, 'Why do you wonder? I will tell you the mystery of the woman and the beast that carries her, which has seven heads and ten horns.'" Now notice, most of this description is about the beast, not about the harlot, but he does add some things about the harlot at the end. Verse 8, "The beast that you saw was and is not, and is about to come up out of the abyss and go to destruction. And those who dwell on the earth whose name has not been written in the book of life from the foundation of the world will wonder when they see the beast, that he was and is not and will come. Here is the mind which has wisdom. The seven heads are seven mountains on which the woman sits. And they are seven kings. Five have fallen. One is, the other has not yet come. And when he comes, he must remain a little while. The beast which was and is not is himself also an eighth, and is one of the seven, and he goes to destruction. The ten horns which you saw are ten kings who have not yet received a kingdom, but they receive authority as kings with the beast for 1 hour. These have one purpose, and they give their power and authority to the beast. These will wage war against the Lamb, and the Lamb will overcome them, because he is Lord of lords and King of kings, and those who are with him are called and chosen and faithful. And he said to me, the waters which you saw where the harlot sits are peoples and multitudes and nations and tongues. And the ten horns which you saw and the beast, these will hate the harlot and will make her desolate and naked and will eat her flesh and will burn her up with fire. For God has put in their hearts to execute his purpose by having a common purpose and by giving their kingdom to the beast until the words of God will be fulfilled. The woman whom you saw is the great city which reigns over the kings of the earth. Now, chapter 18, verses 1 through 8, we have a description of her fall. Okay, her fall of her power and her glory. After these things, I saw another angel coming down from heaven, having great authority, and the earth was illumined with his glory. And he cried out with a mighty voice, saying, fallen, fallen is Babylon the Great. She has become a dwelling place of demons and a prison of every unclean spirit and a prison of every unclean and hateful bird. For all the nations have drunk of the wine of the passion of her immorality, and the kings of the earth have committed acts of immorality with her, and the merchants of the earth have become rich by the wealth of her sensuality. I heard another voice from heaven saying, come out of her, my people, so that you will not participate in her sins and receive of her plagues. For her sins have piled up as high as heaven, and God has remembered her iniquities. Pay her back even as she has paid, and give back to her double according to her deeds. In the cup which she has mixed, mix twice as much for her, to the degree that she glorified herself and lived sensuously. To the same degree, give her torment and mourning, for she says in her heart, I sit a queen and I am not a widow, and I will never see mourning. For this reason, in one day her plagues will come, pestilence and mourning and famine, and she will be burned up with fire, for the Lord God who judges her is strong. Now, starting in verse 9, we find that there are certain groups of people in the world, in particular, that especially lament her downfall. Okay, and they are primarily the kings and the merchants. And if you look at verse 9, and the kings of the earth who committed acts of immorality and lived sensuously with her will weep and lament over her when they see the smoke of her burning, standing at a distance, because of the fear of her torment, saying, woe, woe, the great city Babylon, the strong city, for in 1 hour your judgment has come. And the merchants of the earth weep and mourn over her, because no one buys their cargoes anymore. Cargoes of gold and silver and precious stones and pearls and fine linen and purple and silk and scarlet and every kind of citron wood and every article of ivory and every article made from every costly wood and bronze and iron and marble and cinnamon and spice and incense and perfume and frankincense and wine and olive oil and fine flour and wheat and cattle and sheep and cargoes of horses and chariots and slaves and human lives. A lot of things there. The fruit you long for has gone from you, and all things that were luxurious and splendid have passed away from you, and men will no longer find them. The merchants of these things who became rich from her will stand at a distance because of the fear of her torment, weeping and mourning, saying, woe, woe, the great city, she who was clothed in the fine linen and purple and scarlet, and adorned with gold and precious stones and pearls. For in 1 hour, such great wealth has been laid waste. And every shipmaster and every passenger and sailor And as many as make their living by the sea stood at a distance and were crying out as they saw the smoke of her burning, saying, "What city is like the great city?" They threw dust on their heads and were crying out, weeping and mourning, saying, "Woe, woe, the great city, in which all who had ships at sea became rich by her wealth, for in 1 hour she has been laid waste. Rejoice over her, O heaven, and you saints and apostles and prophets, because God has pronounced judgment for you against her." Now in these closing four verses, it's really a statement of the finality of this fall. In other words, she's not rising from the dead. She's dead. She's gone. Verse 21, "Then a strong angel took up a stone like a great millstone and threw it into the sea, saying, 'So will Babylon, the great city, be thrown down with violence and will not be found any longer.' And the sound of harpists and musicians and flute players and trumpeters will not be heard in you any longer. And no craftsman of any craft will be found in you any longer. And the sound of a mill will not be heard in you any longer. And the light of a lamp will not shine in you any longer, and the voice of the bridegroom and bride will not be heard in you any longer, for your merchants were the great men of the earth, because all the nations were deceived by your sorcery. And in her was found the blood of prophets and of saints and of all who have been slain on the earth." And an amazing passage of Scripture. We might ask why this is an important passage of Scripture. It is important, and I'll say a couple reasons why, briefly. It is important, number one, simply because of its location and the length of it. This is at the very end of Scripture. I mean, we have a couple chapters here yet. You know, the return of Christ and the two chapters on heaven. You know, that's basically what's left here. This is at the very end of Revelation as we have it, and it's this long discourse. It's two chapters. This is God obviously has something to say here. So it's important that we study it. Let me just say that from the standpoint of its location and its length. This is important. And I would also say another reason it's important is because, well, let me give two other reasons. One, because it tells us a lot, and I think you'll discover this as we go through this in the next few weeks. It tells us a lot about how the world works now. Okay, and this is where there's a lot of deception. It tells us an awful lot about the world system as it operates and will operate until the time of Antichrist. It also is important for us to consider this passage because there is a command that goes along with this. What is it? Come out of her. His call to his people, the call to God's people is come out of her. Who is she? We have to know who she is if we're going to come out of her, right? So it is important for us to talk about what is Babylon and what is the whore and what is this passage about. Now, there's probably been more speculation about Babylon than there's been about any other thing in the Bible. There is so much speculation, and I think it's one reason that people are kind of turned off maybe by some of the studies that go on in the book of Revelation, because they go off on all kinds of speculation. Let me just summarize, if I will, and I'm not even going to pretend that I'm familiar with all the explanations that are given or all the commentaries of what they say. It is a passage that I've read about over the years. It's a passage I've thought a lot about over the years. But I'll just summarize that saying basically almost, most commentators over the centuries, from the beginning until now, have somehow associated Babylon with Rome. Now, there are very good reasons for that. We'll see that probably more next week or the next couple weeks than we will tonight. But there are very good reasons to associate this with Rome. But now, in the early years, the tendency was to associate it with pagan Rome. In other words, obviously when John wrote this passage, there was no Roman Catholic Church. There was just Rome. And many people saw Rome as the point, or what John was pointing to, partly because that was the source of all their persecution, okay? And because of its being the heart of paganism. And there's truth to that, okay? There's truth to the fact that pagan Rome is in view here. That's not the whole story. From the time of the Reformation, starting with Martin Luther himself, the tendency has been to equate Babylon, the whore, with the Roman Catholic Church. That is true, and it's true up until even today. There are many that do that. For example, Dave Hunt, most notably, has written his book, The Woman Who Rides the Beast, which is a condemnation of Roman Catholicism. Now, again, there's truth to that, but I don't think that answers the whole equation, as you see, as you go through this. It's not enough, okay? But without question, the Roman Catholic Church is part of this scenario, and I think you'll see that. I think that becomes clear. But that's not enough. You can't just say it's the Roman Catholic Church. That's too narrow, I think. And then there are those, and there's truth to this too, there are those who would associate it with the apostate church at the end of the age. That apostate church that Paul speaks of in 2 Thessalonians chapter 2, the ecumenism. Now, there's truth to that too, but that's still not broad enough. In other words, it's all of those, but much more. And I think you'll see what I'm going to do is I want to be careful about the conclusions I make, but what I want to do over the next couple weeks is build a case for you starting at the ground level. In other words, what I want to do tonight primarily is make observations about this woman. And you'll see how interesting this scenario is. Okay. What is so difficult is when you look at the various explanations that people give, I haven't really come across one that seems to answer every part of the description. That's what's difficult. Okay. And that's why I say it's not enough to say the Roman Catholic Church. It's not enough to say it's the apostate church at the end of the age. It's not enough to say it's pagan Rome. Although those are all elements, okay, in what he's getting at. But it's not the whole picture. It can't be because of the way she's described. Okay. So what I want to do is begin with some preliminary observations that maybe help us to come to conclusions eventually. And we'll gradually, hopefully, explain this. I do think it's important, and I do want to take some time on it. I think it's absolutely a fascinating study, and I think it has some real implications on how we view the world. Okay, so let me begin by making these observations. And I want to begin, or what I want to do tonight is really divide my observations into two main parts, most of them going in the first part. And the first part is this. Let me put it this way. There are two metaphors in the passage in relation to this, whatever you want to call it, entity. Okay, she is, first of all, under the metaphor, the main metaphor of a harlot or a whore. That's the main metaphor throughout the passage. She is a whore. But there's also another metaphor, and I call it a metaphor. I think that's what it is, and I'll explain why when I get there. But it's also under the metaphor of a city. Okay? And there's a reason for that, I think. Okay? In the end, I don't think it's pointing to a literal city. In other words, I don't think what it's talking about is the literal destruction of a literal city at the end of the age, Rome or any other city. Okay? Even though Rome may be the seat of this in the end, okay, I don't think it's talking about the destruction of Rome. I don't think it's talking about the destruction of a city. The city itself, the speaking of a city is a metaphor, and there are reasons I say that, but I'll talk about that when I get there. So let me first begin with the most obvious metaphor, and the one that's obviously the central part of the whole two chapters, and that is this thing, this entity, this Babylon, is seen fundamentally as a whore, a harlot. Now, I don't have to explain what a harlot is or what a whore does. You know what a harlot does and what a whore does. But it is a form of personification. You know, it's a literary technique. Okay, this thing is referred to as if it were a person, and that person is described as a whore, a harlot. Now, I'll say more about what the ramifications are of the metaphor itself, that is, of a harlot, when we get to the end of this section. But let me make observations about this metaphor. First of all, I want to make some observations as we go through this text regarding her relationship to the world. Okay? I want you to see the relationship that this whore has to the world. And the first thing I want you to observe in verse 1 of chapter 17 is that this whore has worldwide influence. Okay? Look at verse 1. Then one of the seven angels who had the seven bowls came and spoke with me, saying, "Come here, I will show you the judgment of the great harlot who sits on many waters." Now, it defines the many waters. What's the many waters? Peoples, nations, and tongues. It's down in verse 15. Okay, where he says very plainly what the waters represent. Said verse 15, "The waters which you saw where the harlot sits are peoples and multitudes and nations and tongues." So that the point is, she does not have, if I can put it this way, a localized influence. She's not just over a region of the world. Her influence is not just a particular group of people or a particular region or a particular religion. Her influence is worldwide. She sits on all the tongues and nations of the world. Okay? And I'll say more about that in a minute. The second observation in regard to this, in regard to her relationships, that her fundamental relationship as a whore is with the kings of the earth. She has a relationship with the kings of the earth, in other words, the rulers of the earth, that is fundamentally described as fornication, as whoredom. Okay, that's her relationship with the kings of the earth. Notice again in verse 2, "with whom the kings of the earth committed acts of immorality." That's just fornication. That's the Greek word, fornication. In other words, you know what a whore does. Well, who she's doing it with are kings. Okay, she is committing fornication with kings. Now, not literal, okay, but what? Spiritual. Okay? She's committing spiritual fornication with kings. And you'll notice that she also, this relationship with kings, is also seen in verse 3. "And he carried me away in the spirit into a wilderness, and I saw a woman sitting on a scarlet beast, full of blasphemous names, having seven heads and ten horns." So she's sitting on the beast. Now, the beast, without going into all the detail, which we're going to get to eventually, the beast, again, ultimately is the Antichrist system, right? It's ultimately the nations, the system of the nations of the world. Okay, what does a rider on the beast usually do? Controls. Her relationship with these kings is they, and again, not to be graphic, but they get something out of it, right? Okay, they get what they want. And she gains control. She controls the kings of the earth. And this is made pretty plain at the end of chapter 17 and verse 18. It's pretty plain. "The woman whom you saw is the great city who reigns over the kings of the earth." She rides the beast. She steers it. She drives it. She is the one who rules the kings. Okay? Whoever she is. Whatever she is, she really is ruling the kings. She also has a relationship with all the people of the earth, not just kings. The second part of verse 2, "And those who dwell on the earth were made drunk with the wine of her immorality." So now we have a woman who has influence not only over the kings, but over all the earth, over all the people of the earth, the inhabitants themselves. If you look again at verse chapter 18, verse 3, "The second angel poured out his bowl," I'm in the wrong chapter, 18, verse 3, "For all the nations have drunk of the wine of the passion of her immorality." So all the nations have drunk of this wine. Not some, all. Or down in verse 23, at the end of the verse, it says, "For your merchants were the great men of the earth, because all the nations were deceived by your sorcery." Okay, so in other words, this woman not only has influence over all the kings of the earth, but has influence over all the inhabitants of the earth. Okay? The fourth thing that I would point out in regard to her relationship, which is prominent in chapter 18, is that she has a relationship with the merchants of the earth. And what's that pointing at? Economics, business. Okay? Now look what it says again in chapter 18, verse 3. For all nations have drunk of the wine of the passions of immorality, and the kings of the earth have committed acts of immorality with her, and the merchants of the earth have become rich by the wealth of her sensuality. In other words, because of her immorality, because of her fornication with the kings, the merchants of the earth have gotten wealthy. She has an influence on the whole world economy. You might say she's the source of it. Okay? Now look again in verse 11 and verse 15. This is why they mourn. It says, and the merchants of the earth weep and mourn over her because no one buys their cargoes anymore. In other words, when she's destroyed, it's the end of their economy. It's the end of their world because no one... I think this will be plain as we go through this, but you understand what happens here is they become poor. You know, they've lost their business. When she goes down, they go down. In fact, as we read chapter 18, the people who mourn the most are the merchants, the owners of ships and the owners of businesses and the sellers of these things. They're the ones who lose out more than anybody in this whole deal, right? And they lament. Or look at verse 15. The merchants of these things who became rich from her will stand at a distance because of the fear of her torment, weeping and mourning. They're going to be weeping over the loss of Babylon. Okay? Now that's her relationship. Okay, so, yes, Gary. Well, there's no question about it that the greatest probably in most fields have been Jews, whether you talk about science, whether you talk about math, whether you talk about arts, whether you talk about... Yeah, no, that's true. But this isn't talking about a people group. That's very important. This is not talking about a people group. And that's clear from, as you again, work through these things. It's not talking about Jews. It's not talking about anybody in particular as a people group, if that makes sense. But notice, again, just to summarize her relationship, she is worldwide influence. She reigns over the kings. She has an effect upon all the inhabitants of the earth. In other words, they become drunk. Okay, and she has a relationship, if I can put it this way, that really, she has a relationship with the merchants of the earth. Okay, she is the cause for their success. Okay, because of the relationship that she has with kings, and because of her sensuality. Any questions about anything I've said so far? Yes. Well, we'll get to that. Okay? We'll get to that. That's a good question. Anything else? Now, you can see just from what I've said how difficult it is to pin this down. But it even gets harder. Okay? Now, let me say some words about her character and her nature. Okay? She is first of all, and this is kind of obvious throughout the text, she is first of all immoral and profligate. Okay? Truly. Okay? She's immoral. Okay? That's kind of obvious from the text, just from the metaphor itself. She's a whore. Okay? This is someone who is a rebel. This is again, someone. It's a personification. Okay? It's not a particular individual. It's a personification. This entity, whatever it is immoral. It's profligate. It's wicked. Okay? The second thing we observe from verse 4 of chapter 17 is that it is lavishly wealthy. Whatever it is extremely wealthy. And this is observed in several places. Verse 4, the woman was clothed in purple and scarlet. Obviously, that's the this is the robes of kings, queens, adorned with gold and precious stones and pearls, having in her hand a gold cup full of abominations and of the unclean things of immorality. So here's a woman with extreme wealth. Now you can, just reading that description, okay, you can understand why people from the Reformation equated this with the Roman Catholic Church. That's not hard. In fact, the image that comes to my mind, I've just been, as I pointed out before, I'm reading a two-volume set on the English Reformation. Fascinating stuff. But Cardinal Wolsey, who was Henry, actually, for all intents and purposes, ruled England during the early part of Henry VIII's reign, was the cardinal over all of England. And you read about his description, and they wore red garments, extremely wealthy, and they would actually, their slippers, their shoes they wore were full of precious gems and pearls, and they made people kiss them. You can imagine, it doesn't take too much imagination to take verse 4 and think Roman Catholic Church, if you know about what happened at the time of the Reformation, okay? I don't think that's ultimately the point, but you can see why, people would make that connection. And there are other things here. But notice, she's very, very wealthy. You see this again in chapter 18, verse 7. To the degree that she glorified herself and lived sensuously, to the same degree give her torment and mourning. For she says in her heart, I sit as a queen and I am not a widow and will never see mourning. Okay, there's arrogance here, but there's wealth. She sees herself as invincible. She's absolutely untouchable. So there's also arrogance there, but she's lavishly wealthy. And then we find also, this is also important, she's violent. And I'm skipping verse 5 for a minute. I'm going to come back to verse 5. But look at verse 6. I saw the woman drunk with the blood of the saints and with the blood of the witnesses of Jesus. She's drunk with the blood of the martyrs. She is responsible for the blood of all of those who are killed for the name of Christ. Now again, you can see how at the time of the Reformation, they would have equated this with Rome, because who killed all the martyrs? I mean, look at the Inquisition in Spain. Look at how all the men and women that were put to death in England. All the martyrs of the Anabaptists, most of them were put to death by Charles V, the Catholic Emperor of the Holy Roman Empire. Many countless people were put to death by the Roman Inquisitions and by the Roman Catholic Church. And you can understand why, again, people would equate that. But again, I'm going to suggest it's broader than that. But also look, it's even broader in verse 24 of chapter 18, the very last verse. It says, and in her was found the blood of prophets and of saints and of all who have been slain on the earth. That's a broad statement. I don't think that means that she's literally responsible for every single person who's ever been killed or murdered. I don't think that's what it's saying. But what I do think it's saying, what I do think it's getting at, and I think you'll understand why I say this eventually, but I think what it's getting at is that she is ultimately responsible for the wars that have taken place on the earth. That's where most of the men have been slain. She is responsible for those wars. Which makes sense, because what? She rules over the kings. And who makes war? Kings. Okay. She's the one that has brought those wars about. She's the one responsible for those wars. Because of her manipulation of the kings. Okay. And you can understand why this gets rather complex and why it's rather hard to pin it down to a particular thing. But it's rather interesting. Now there's another issue, another description of her, which is even more intriguing. And it's in verse 5. And on her forehead was a name that was written, a mystery. I stop there. A mystery. Oh, she's Mystery Babylon. Okay? She's a mystery. I think what that's pointing to is fundamentally that she's hidden. This entity, whatever it is not known by the average common Joe in the street. They don't know about her. It's a mystery. She's hidden. Her influence is unseen by the world. And I think that's part of the reason that John is in such wonder. It's interesting, John's response. He says, at the very end of verse 6, he says, when I saw her, I wondered greatly. And actually, in the Greek, it's literally, I wondered with wonderment. The same word twice, really. And the idea is, he was in awe. And I think part of the reason he was in awe is because of not only her great power, but that she was a mystery. In other words, she was hidden. Her influence was not overt. And again, doesn't that fit the picture of a harlot? She's a woman of the night. Okay. And then, this really gets interesting, she is called the mother of harlots. I'm going to skip over the mystery. I'm going to skip over Babylon just a moment because that's where I'm going to end. But she's called the mother of harlots and of the abominations of the earth. Now let me just stop for a minute and ask this question. You know what a harlot is. What is a harlot in Scripture representative of? Idolatry. Okay? We could say, we could observe that there are two other prominent women in the book of Revelation. Who are they? Israel in Revelation 12, the woman who gives birth to the child, and the bride. Both of those represent what? God's people. God's people. The woman in chapter 12 refers to Israel, God's people. The bride refers, I believe, to the church, God's people. These are faithful. Who is the harlot? What does she represent ultimately? Idolatry, false religion. But what makes this especially interesting is that she's not just the harlot, she's the mother of all harlots. In other words, out of her come all the false religious systems. She's the mother of them. She has produced them. Interesting to think about. But what I want to especially, you'll see how this works. I think this is very, very interesting. But observe that she is fundamentally a religious system. Okay? That is fundamentally why she's called a harlot. She is a religious system. Okay? She's a religious system out of whom all other religious systems have come. She's the mother of them all. Okay? Now, notice, again, rehearsing what we've said, it is a religious system that rules the kings of the earth. It is a religious system that has made all the inhabitants of the earth drunk. And it is a religious system that has resulted in the wealth of her merchants. In other words, she is the reason there is a world economy. She is the essence of it. She is the promoter of it. She is the builder of it. She is the maintainer of it. Okay? This religious system. You understand? And at the same time, she is hidden. She's a mystery. Okay. Now notice something else. And that is her end. And this also is interesting. Verse 16 and 17. It says, "And the 10 horns which you saw and the beast, these will hate the harlot and will make her desolate and naked and will eat her flesh and will burn her up with fire. For God has put it in their hearts to execute his purpose by having a common purpose and by giving their kingdom to the beast until the words of God will be fulfilled." So now we find that this woman, this harlot, this religious system that has ruled the kings of the earth will be thrown off by the beast. In other words, now let me just observe that It is the system, and this is important to understand, it is the system through which the beast will gain control. Okay, the way in which the beast becomes the Antichrist, the way in which he actually comes to rule the world is going to be through her. In other words, he commits fornication with her just like all the other kings of the earth do, and that's how he gets his power. That's how he raises up. Now, that's why many people associate this with the apostate church. You see, it's the apostate church that's going to lead the people to the Antichrist. And it's going to be through that apostate church that the Antichrist is going to come to full power. But when he comes to power, he throws her off. He destroys her, burns her. And what some people have said, well, this is the Roman Catholic Church, and what's going to happen? And I think there's truth to this. I don't think it's the whole picture. Through the Roman Catholic Church, the apostate church is going to be formed, complete ecumenism, which, by the way, is what the Catholic Church is doing. They are, through the ecumenical movement, I know this sounds strange, but they are what is behind all these ecumenical movements, including the charismatic movement itself, including all these reaching outs to Islam and Hinduism, including things like contemplative prayer. Who is behind this? It is the Roman Catholic Church. Now, there are a lot of proofs of that. I'm not going to go into that. But the point is this, that she is going to bring all the people together under her and into a one-world religion that when she's done, the Antichrist is going to throw her off. Okay? Now, I think that's what it's saying fundamentally, but I'm maybe getting ahead of myself. My point is this, that she is thrown off by the Antichrist. And what I think that means is the whole religious system is thrown off, and what do we have? We worship the Antichrist. The world, that is. Okay? And who controls the economic world? The Antichrist. And I think that's the point. So when is this Babylon? If you follow those verses, when is she thrown off? When is she destroyed? She's not destroyed at the very end. She's destroyed, apparently, somewhere around the middle of the tribulation, when the Antichrist takes power. That's what verse 17 seems to be saying. For God has put it in their hearts to execute his purpose by having a common purpose and by giving their kingdom to the beast. In other words, when these 10 kings give their power to the beast, that's when they destroy this religious system that has control, them and the kingdoms before them. Now that leads me finally to her name. Her name ultimately is Babylon the Great. Babylon the Great. Now that's, of course, interesting. Why, first of all, and I'm just asking this and we'll answer it more fully, but why is she named after a city? Why is this religious system named after a city in general, and why is she named Babylon in particular? Because Babylon isn't in existence. And really, at the time that John wrote this, Babylon was pretty much, it wasn't non-existent, but it was it was not of any significance, really. Why does he call it Babylon? Well, the answer to that, really, more fully, will be next week. But I will say a few words, and I want to talk about the metaphor of a city for just a moment. Because there are also some things we can observe about why it's called a city. Now, I don't think it's a literal city in the end. And what I mean by that, it's based on a literal city, Babylon, okay, and a history of a literal city, Babylon. But it is not fundamentally Babylon. In other words, I don't think it's talking about the destruction of Babylon at the end of the age. And there are people that believe that Babylon is going to rise up as a city and rule the world, and that's what he's going to destroy. I don't think that's what it's saying. Now, the reason I say that is fundamentally because we are called in chapter 18, in verse 4, to come out of her. God says to his people, come out of her. I ask you, is he asking us to leave a particular geographical location? Is he? No. He's not asking us to leave a geographical location. It's not as if, okay, all you people who live in Rome, get out of Rome. That's not what he's saying. OK? Okay, he's not, okay, all you live in Babylon, leave. No, he's not talking about the literal place. But there's a reason he does call it Babylon, and that's what we're going to get into next week. But I want to just stop for a minute and ask why he calls it a city. Why does he call it after a city? Now, we went through why she's called a whore, and I think fundamentally the point there is it's religious. It's religious idolatry. It's a religious system. Here, I think there's also a point. What is a city? How would you define a city? I know you don't think about it because it's not something you have to define. It's something you take for granted. What's the first element of a city? If you don't have this, you don't have a city.
People.
Okay? Now, if we just had a whole pile of people all together living in one spot, would that make a city? No. Okay? What is a city besides people? Obviously, it's people. What else is it? Government. First of all, it's government, which implies organization, which implies hierarchy, which implies that there are, you know, there's citizenship, there's membership. There's a lot more that goes into a city, like things like culture, infrastructure. Okay? My point is this, that I think he's pointing at an entity that is like a city. In other words, it has membership. There are people that are part of this entity that are organized. In other words, there are people, members of this, whatever it is, this religious system that actually does control kings. This isn't just some amorphous thing. This has structure. And when this structure goes, if I could put it this way, this is the picture when you read Revelation 18. When this structure is destroyed, civilization as we know it ends. That's really what happens. That's why they're weeping. It's the end. It's the end of civilization as they know it at that time. Why? Because this entity, this city, this governing organization that is over the kings, that has made this economy, that has done all this, is gone. And what's it replaced by? The Antichrist. The Antichrist, who will reduce everyone to poverty and will have complete control. That's why they'll all be weeping. They'll be weeping because their prosperity's gone. And their civilization as they knew it was gone. And the foundation of that civilization was this city, this entity called Babylon. Well, why Babylon? Well, that's next week. Babylon, as you know, is a city, was a city. And we will start next week by looking at, first of all, and by the way, there's a lot of interesting information about Babylon. And maybe I'll just say a couple words about it before we close. If you would, let me just say, if you were to look in a concordance, where would you expect all the references to Babylon to be, roughly? What's that? Okay, you're talking about Genesis? Yeah, that. And, yeah, Daniel. Definitely Daniel. Well, what event is most familiar to us in regard to Babylon? Okay, Tower of Babel, yeah. But even, I mean, if you're talking about quantity of material in the Old Testament, it's what? It's Israel being taken captive, right? Jerusalem being destroyed, taken captive to Babylon. And that's where most of the vast majority, really most of the references to Babylon are. In fact, more than half, there's almost 300 references to Babylon in the Bible, and over half of them are in the book of Jeremiah. Okay? Over half of them. And of course, Jeremiah was the prophet when that happened. So that gives you an idea. And actually, most of them refer to Nebuchadnezzar, you know, the king of Babylon. But it's a very interesting story, the story of Babylon, and we'll look at that next week. But there are three clear judgments that are given against the city of Babylon in the Old Testament. Two of them in Isaiah, one of them in Jeremiah. They're lengthy, especially the one in Jeremiah. They're very lengthy, and it's what the book of Revelation borrows a lot of when it describes Babylon and its fall in Revelation. It's the same language. It borrows its, a lot of quotes and references to those three judgments. So we'll start next week by looking at the city of Babylon and especially its history in the Old Testament, and then how it relates to this, which is hopefully will build and will help you understand what this is. Any questions before we close our word of prayer? Daniel? Oh. Go ahead. Oh, that's a good question. But to explain that, I'm going to have to wait. I'll just say this. Yeah, I think I better wait. I think if once I explain this, I think it will become clear. I think you'll understand it. But for me to go into that would be to go into what I'm going to go in next week, and it might be a little bit hard to explain in a nutshell. That's when the fall, yeah, that's the destruction of Babylon takes place, I believe, right near the midpoint of the tribulation. Again, I wouldn't be dogmatic. Some people have said actually before the rapture. It will be, I believe, before that midpoint or just around the time of the midpoint. When the Antichrist takes over, I think, is when it's destroyed ultimately. But yeah, that's how I understand it based on chapter 17. You know, it's the 10 kings who, when they give their power to the beast, the Antichrist, that's when they overthrow. In other words, they take charge now. In other words, the kings have always been, if you will, slaves to this woman, and they're going to throw her off. And he's going to actually truly take over. That's the picture. Daniel. Yeah, that's also a good question. And the one that comes to my mind actually is the one in Ecclesiastes, which I taught on a Wednesday night a couple years ago. And I was going to bring that up probably eventually. Yeah, I do think there is a point there. In other words, those passages in the wisdom literature that speak about a harlot, it is talking about literal harlotry, I think, but it seems to be pointing beyond that. I don't think the average guy has a temptation for a harlot, okay? I think it's pointing to, and I think it's especially true in Ecclesiastes 7, that passage, I think it's pointing to the temptation to get caught up in this system, which is Babylon, which is why we're told in Revelation to what? Come out of her, okay? No, that's a good point, good question. I think we'll address that. Well, that's a good question, too. I want to be really careful about prognostication. Do I think that what's going on in the world economy generally? I'll just say this. I think it could be the beginnings of it. Without question, I think the coming of Antichrist will involve a complete economic earthquake. The destruction of the economy as we know it. Is that what's going on now? I think it's possible. But, and I know this sounds bizarre, but I'll say it because I do think it's true. I think it's by design. Okay? I don't think it's, you know, these guys in the media, you know, they look at, like, all these guys are wringing their hands. What are we going to do? What are we going to do? I think they know exactly what they're going to do. They're not idiots. Okay, I think this is by design. They can't bring in a world system, which they keep talking about. They can't bring in a world system unless they collapse the one that's right now. So I think it's by design, by somebody's design. And I think, is this the collapse? I don't know. I mean, I'm not a prophet. But I'm not even going to pretend I know. But. Well, Islam is related. I mean, Islam obviously is one of the children of the harlots. But I think, again, when we get to the end of this, I think you'll realize how Islam, at least at some in some ways, is related. It's not Islam. Islam isn't the main thing. Islam is a tool. Okay, that's what I'm saying. This is a mystery. It's hidden. It's not the Roman Catholic Church. It's not Islam. It's a mystery. It's Mystery Babylon, which we don't have a name for because nobody knows what it is. That sounds odd. I think you'll understand. Again, I'm setting you up for next week. Okay, so come back next week and we'll talk hopefully about what is Mystery Babylon. It's not Islam. It's not Roman Catholicism, although both of them are closely related to Mystery Babylon. And in fact, maybe the clearest manifestation of it is the Roman Catholic Church. But I don't think you can just say it's the same thing. So, all right. Ron, can I ask you to just close in a word of prayer?